Are we there already? I asked, remembering our quick trip into space when we had observed their planet. The young lady laughed. Howard, we haven't even left the ground yet. We can tune in and observe any planet in close-up with our instruments. I watched the screen as it momentarily went dark, then tuned in a close-up of what I presumed was a crater. As the fuzzy image was brought into sharp focus, I could see blues and greens showing in the darkness of the crater. How is it that our astronomers can't see these colors? I asked, and she answered, "Your instruments are limited because you use light which is of a secondary energy and reflected off the atmosphere, which, in turn, reflects an effect of atmospheric distortions. We do not use this type of energy. Our source of energy, though it be secondary, is without distortion. We can pick up and even photograph forms in your own atmosphere of which you have no concept." Trevor James in his book, They Live in the Sky, New Age Publishing Co., 1542 Glendale Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, $4.50, claims to have photographed animal-like forms in the sky by the use of infrared film and filters, and presents the pictures in the volume. Could this be what the space people referred to? The publisher, as the view screen then focused away from the crater and over the general terrain, I saw dome-shaped buildings coming into view and a craft making a landing near one of them. At this instant I felt the slight jerk sometimes associated with taking off and knew we were on our way into space. The view screen darkened. A sliding panel opened in the wall and two people entered, Earth people. I noted with surprise, led by a space brother. I was further surprised at recognizing them, for they were people I knew. They joined us at the table. There were now 9 people in the craft, 8 at the table and 1 man at the controls. We greeted the newcomers as the room darkened again, the view screen again lighted and we saw the moon once more. We seemed to be approaching it at a tremendous rate of speed. Now and then I saw the now familiar objects approaching us and veering away, but I knew the meteors could never strike our craft due to the shielding field. The moon, of which we had seen a relatively small image, had grown larger and now filled the screen. Land masses began to appear and the terrain became more distinct. I asked how fast we were going, and the pilot told me 82,000 miles per hour. We will decrease or increase this speed according to the density of a shower of what I will term objects ahead of us. Meteors? No, not exactly. They represent matter in the form of different elements present in space which eventually form planets under the control of a funneling magnetic influence. These and meteors will present a hazard to future expeditionary rockets from your planet unless you discover the secret of repelling this material. The others were not asking questions. Instead, they were deeply engrossed in the picture of the moon's surface. From watching the screen, I figured we had traveled around it at least twice, for I had seen certain terrain revolve past the field of view twice. At one time, we caught sight of Earth in the distance, glowing bluish-white with tinges of red, floating like a tennis ball in an inky, black pool. As I saw the Earth, I grabbed my camera and waited until I caught sight of our planet through a portal and quickly got it in the viewfinder. I also tried some shots of the moon. Of the 5 photographs, only 3 came out, and they were blurred, but to me they are indeed priceless and proof that had orbited the moon. "You're on your way home," the man accompanying the young lady announced, and the view screen switched to a shot of the Earth approaching rapidly. When we landed at the field from which we had embarked, I checked my watch and found we had been gone only 2 hours. We parted company, each of our cars going separate ways. "Don't look so disappointed, Howard," the young lady said as we left them, "perhaps the next time you'll land." 26. Destination Luna. In September, I again met the same agent at Biseka's Diner, the meeting again arranged by a telephone call. This time he was alone. After having coffee, we left in my car and drove to the same field from which we had embarked previously. "Well, Howard," my friend announced as we neared the location, This time I think we're going to land on the moon. If we do, you will have a great experience. One craft was waiting for us. As we entered it, I was again surprised to see people whom I and members of my Thursday night group knew personally. One of them, an elderly man, was not, however, a member of any saucer group, but a fellow of great prestige in his community. I knew personally that at one or more times in his life he had been persecuted by orthodox agencies of conformity. I was so moved with emotion in meeting my old friend that I actually burst into tears. His eyes filled with warmth as we greeted each other, then after greetings were exchanged all around, the craft took off, destination Moon. This time only 6 people were aboard, 1 space visitor at the controls, 1 at the table acting as instructor, and 4 people from Earth. The man at the controls began speaking with a slight accent through a loudspeaker, "My friends, this trip will be a longer one than the previous journey. You will soon go through a processing, whereby a complete change will take place in your atomic physical system. Each atom of your physical body will undergo a processing which will change its polarity, frequency and vibration, to adjust your body from its balance to the Earth's attractive inertial mass to that of the Moon's. This will require approximately 1.5 weeks, Earth time. Do not be alarmed at the initial effects. Nothing can harm you. Now keep your eyes on the view screen." We looked at the screen and saw the Earth fast diminishing in size as we sped away from it. Again the voice reassured us, "Please do not be alarmed. Remember that we are only expressions or projections of reality, which in truth does not exist. You are being changed atomically to fit a reality of expression, or what you call the Moon. When reach it, my friends, you may observe and take pictures at will, but the processing will continue as we orbit the Moon and will seem to involve 1.5 weeks of your time." The lights dimmed and were supplanted by a yellowish glow over the entire room, then the lights came on again, and I felt a strange sensation. For a few seconds breathing seemed difficult, but then it became easier and easier. It is difficult to describe my physical and mental feelings. I seemed to think more clearly, to compose my thoughts and reach conclusions more quickly. The senses seemed to be stimulated. Colors became more vivid, the sense of smell became sharper, for I remember becoming aware of perspiration odors of myself and companions. My sense of touch must have been accentuated, for I could feel the seat under me more distinctly, though it in no way made me uncomfortable. The man at the controls explained the processing was now being carried out and would be continued. The instructor sitting with us saw one of us stifle a yawn. He laughed and mentioned something about it being our bedtime. For the first time I wondered just where we would sleep. He led us through a doorway into the sleeping quarters, which were arranged in sections with 3 beds, bunk style, one atop the other, to each compartment. My elderly friend, myself and another man were assigned to one of the sections. I said, "Well, we might as well try them out," as I climbed to the top bunk and stretched out. My elderly friend sat on the bottom bunk and felt the softness of what must have been a mattress. "Ah!" he exclaimed, "this is really something." I removed my outside clothing and put them on a kind of built-in hanger, set my shoes on a ledge. The bed did not feel overly soft, instead it seemed to give just the correct extent to support the contour of the body. I laid my head in a flat pad of soft material, pulled the single warm, but extremely light, coverlet over myself. Despite the excitement of the day, I fell asleep quickly. We were awakened by a gentle knocking on the sliding compartment door. It was our instructor who said it was time to get up. I looked at my watch, and discovered we had slept only 4 hours, yet I felt rested and refreshed, as if it had been 8 or 9 hours. My first reaction upon arising was to go to the portal and look out to see where we were. Various blobs of light of different colors filled the field of vision, along with one giant red ball, which looked like a huge planet. Later I was told it was the sun, though I never understood why it did not appear bright. Angelslight.org. Next on the agenda was a warm, invigorating shower in a compartment containing 3 or 4 cubicles, partitioned by translucent walls. When I stepped inside one of the cubicles, the door closed behind me and lights went on automatically. I saw automatic controls for room and water temperature. 3 shower heads, one above me and 2 at waist level, could be operated separately or all together. I pushed a button and a flow of water, apparently mixed with warm air, for it was quite bubbly, fell over my body. I had never had a shower so invigorating. I looked around for soap, but there was none. Seeing another button I had not previously pushed, I put my finger on it and a stream of a colorless solution came from the shower heads and completely lathered my body. At the same time the water was turned off. I pushed the soap button, then the water button, alternately, enjoying the novelty like a small boy would have done. I could hear my friend trying to sing in the next cubicle and assumed he had mastered the technology of the shower, though fortunately, for my musical sensibilities, the partitions were partly soundproof. "Howard," I heard him call faintly, "this thing had better be what I think it is, for I'm going to use it." The sanitary facility to which he obviously referred looked very much like one on Earth, except that the bowl was lower to the floor and was made of a hard white translucent material, not a ceramic. A kind of sink with the same bubbly water was a part of a built-in vanity arrangement, complete with mirror. I looked at my face, thinking I would have to borrow a razor from someone. Surprisingly, my beard had not grown, and throughout the trip we found it unnecessary to shave. I stepped out of the cubicle into the main room and joined 2 others already waiting there. Then I smelled food and suddenly discovered I was ravenously hungry. Our instructor opened a compartment in the wall and withdrew some items of processed food, which he put into a deep well, or pot, set into a sink-like unit. He pushed a button and the pot filled with liquid. He allowed the food to seep in the liquid for about 5 minutes, then he drained the liquid from the pot. He pushed another button and almost instantly the appearance of the food changed and steam rose from it. It had been cooked in little more than a second. "You will forgive me," he said apologetically, "if I do not don the traditional caps sometimes worn on Earth during such operations, particularly the backyard amateur kind of barbecue cook." He removed the food from the pot by means of a large, deep strainer and transferred it to plastic-like plates which he said were disposable. He set the plates on the table. "No, I haven't forgotten your juice," he laughed, and drew fresh juice from a spigot in the food compartment wall. During the trip we enjoyed many kinds of processed foods, including cabbage, parsley, carrots, potatoes, very large wheat kernels, kernels of corn. We used a green mineral salt to season our foods, and I particularly enjoyed some kind of spread, similar to avocado butter, but white in color. Often we were served nuts from other planets, though only the nut meats, and I didn't have a chance to see the shells. One of them, large and almost a meal in itself, was served in slices. Another kind tasted something like a Brazil nut. I remember eating with great pleasure a fruit which was about 6 inches in diameter, round, smooth, orange to red in color, with skin like a nectarine. When one bit into it he found it very juicy. It tasted like a combination of peach and plum. The pit was small, and looked something like a plum pit. All of the vegetables were very tasty. The potatoes had a meaty, nut-like flavor, probably because of the high protein content. The parsley leaves were much larger than our variety, but less strong in flavor. My friends who read this will probably laugh at my talking so much about the food, to the exclusion of many other interesting things, for they know what an enthusiastic eater I am. However, we passed our conditioning period away in many other pleasant ways. We listened to music which came from the Earth and other planets as well, and constantly we talked to our space friends, learning much from them. The view screen proved to be a constant source of interest and delight as we tuned in on different planets and saw scenes of these fascinating worlds. We communicated through the view screen with other craft, and other agents in different locations on the Earth, the Moon and elsewhere. There wasn't a dull moment. I am not certain how long we spent in these pleasant occupations, but, estimating by my watch, I believed it to be about 10 days. I have often thought that time might have been different, possibly because my beard didn't seem to grow, but that could have been a result of our conditioning. However, all our other bodily functions seemed to progress normally. Although there weren't any no smoking signs and I assume it would have been all right with the crew, I noticed nobody smoked during the trip, or later on the moon. For the first time in years I had no desire to puff on my faithful old pipe. Again I reflect that time seemed to stand still, and yet there was constant activity on board the craft. I am still perplexed, and confess, that the matter of time is still too complicated a subject for my becoming intellectually involved. 27. Sightseeing tour. Finally came the long-awaited announcement. Through the loudspeaker the man at the control panel informed us we were preparing to land on the moon. He motioned me to him and I walked to his seat at the panel. He opened a kind of drawer and handed me a metallic object which contained colored filters. "Hold these over your camera lens when you take pictures," he instructed. I remembered I should be taking pictures and hurriedly grabbed my camera, began snapping through a porthole. I got an especially good picture showing cloud formations and the atmosphere around the moon, but as we came closer to the surface I noticed the photographs did not come out well. We were approaching a huge dome-shaped building, about 150 feet in diameter and perhaps 50 feet high. I could see colored lights flashing inside it, shining through the translucent material of which it was constructed. As we rounded the building and prepared to land, I noticed a base or pedestal of solid white material on which the dome structure rested. I became more aware of the simple beauty of the lovely, iridescent, pearl-like structure. As we landed, I saw we were gliding across a flat copper-colored road toward a huge opening in the base of the structure. The door of our craft opened and we stepped out on a ramp which led down to the floor of the building, which appeared to be a huge aerodrome. Moving ramps led up to other floors, and I guessed there must be at least 2 levels above the ground floor. Next we were led to a huge lounge, with potted plants and flowers lining the walls and attractively arranged near seating units. Sculptured bas reliefs decorated the walls. Attractive ladies in flowing pastel gowns came toward us smiling, offered us refreshments. We took the drinks and sat on a long circular couch in front of a view screen. Several screens, without sound, were on at the same time. If one wished to listen to any one of them, he had but to push an appropriate button. The screens seemed to be transmitting regular programs from different planets. Some of them were educational, while others appeared to be designed purely for entertainment. The ladies explained we were waiting for our guides, who soon showed up. They told us I was to split up with my companions who were going with a different group from my own. I followed along with my assigned group and came to what I guessed was an elevator shaft, as a guide pushed a button and they assumed we were going to another level. To my surprise, the door opened upon a corridor which led to a long train-like vehicle with 10 or 15 couches with plastic domes over them. Each couch must have been 50 feet long. The strange vehicle had no wheels, rested in suspension about a foot above the copper highway which ribboned through the terrain and disappeared from view. We boarded the train and soon were gliding noiselessly above the highway. As we traveled, we could see all around and above us. If I write another book, perhaps I can at that time take enough space to describe my visit in some detail, but it would take hundreds of pages to do it justice. Instead, I shall review it quite briefly. We seemed to be on a tour. First, we were taken from building to building, then apparently out of the city. We passed mountains, went through valleys, visited underground installations, every few seconds people of our party would give out with O's and R's, as some new breathtaking sight appeared. Some of the terrain, in one section of the moon near the so-called dark side, reminded me of Flagstaff, Arizona, while other desert section made me think of Nevada. Huge cliffs and mountains made our own look like ant hills. One particular desert locale brought to mind the Valley of Fire in Nevada. There we stopped long enough for our guide to open the door and permit us to stick our heads out for a brief moment, which was all one could take, for it was terribly hot outside, like a blast furnace. I was certain no one could have lived outside very long and was glad he had shut the door. At that moment a huge bullet-shaped object, broken and protruding from the sand where it had crashed, came into view, giving silent testimony to man's pitiful attempts at getting into space by brute force. Our guide confirmed that it represented a brave attempt by some unknown planet, and at the same time spoke with great respect for whom he termed intrepid men from a distant world. Apparently the rocket was the second stage of a much larger craft. Watching the tragic scene as it quickly flashed by, I assumed that the end of the craft, consisting of four spheres which looked as if they were supposed to revolve, had contained the men, and should have separated from the second stage in order to effect a landing. Something had gone wrong as it had remained attached. Still not naming the planet of origin, our guide added the rocket had crashed there in that blast furnace of a desert in the Earth year 1944. Finally we came to another large dome-shaped building, where we halted and our guide told us we could get out on the moon's surface where we could breathe their air with little or no difficulty. That pleased the group, for we were eager to stretch our legs. My first impression was that I was in the desert. The air was warm and dry. I could see little wind funnels forming on the ground, drawing up dust particles like tiny whirlwinds. I looked up at the sky. It was a yellowish color. When looking, I had the queer impression that if I walked some distance I would fall off, since the horizon seemed foreshortened. In the distance we could see the jagged edges of high mountains etched black against the saffron-colored sky. The ground beneath our feet was like yellowish-white powdery sand, with stones and boulders here and there as we looked around us. Along with its weird beauty, the landscape of that side of the moon had an air of desolateness difficult to describe. I remembered wishing the rocket we had seen had tried landing on the other side of the moon, where the crew would probably have had a better chance to survive. Once again we were separated into smaller groups, according to language, and each given a guide who spoke its particular language. Along with ordinary folk, scientists, geologists, electronic engineers, rocket experts, Annie Auf, whom I knew personally, astronomers, I also knew one of them, and other learned people made up our group. In the other groups I had spotted hundreds of Russians, Japanese, Germans and other people from other nations. Despite the language barrier, however, it seemed all the people in the tour had a kind of common bondage of understanding and brotherhood. Warm smiles and hearty handshakes abounded when there was no vocal way of communication. Since I was an ordinary lay observer, I was not shown many of the things the technicians were allowed to inspect, but I probably would not have understood the concepts anyhow. All of us were shown musical instruments, samples of art and architecture, and other interesting things. In fact, one building was like an intergalactic world fair, with each space-friend planet represented by some sort of contribution in art, technology and so on. They also showed us their advanced horticultural operations, and in one place I saw flowers and plants growing in long vats of jelly-like substance. We were shown how clothing was cleaned by a kind of high-frequency sonics, and passed, in one building, trays of exquisitely cut gems which we were permitted to handle and inspect. The multitude of sights we witnessed was enough to stagger the imagination. Our wonder probably could be compared to that of an aborigine from Australia on a sightseeing tour of New York City for the first time. After 4 days of this lunar junket, we were finally treated to a huge dinner by our hosts, With such a spirit of happiness and goodwill permeating all of us, it made me wonder if what I was seeing and hearing were not just all a beautiful dream. But I had been able to take photographs to prove my trip, though only of the dome-shaped buildings, the craft and some mountains. For some reason I was never allowed to take photographs of surface detail, people, their mechanical installations and the like. The dinner signaled our departure and, once again in the ship, it seemed our reprocessing consumed very little time. Before we knew it, we were back on Earth, disembarking at the same field from which we had left. As I drove off in my car, I wondered if the storm which we had seen brewing over the South Pacific on the view screen would hit soon or be dissipated before it reached the lower atmosphere. To book to landing. I, questions and answers about flying saucers because of the many letters asking for certain information, and the question and answer period after each of my lectures, I have thought it helpful to collect some of the most asked questions to present, with my answers, to their readers. Q. What is a flying saucer? A. An interplanetary spacecraft. Q. Where do they come from? A. From other planets outside this solar system. Q. Who has seen them? A. Thousands of people all over the world. Q. What do they look like? A. Saucer-shaped, as the name implies, disc-shaped, bell-shaped and so on. They may often appear to take on different shapes and colors due to the magnetic fields surrounding them. Q. Where do we see them? A. In flight, in skies all over the world. They land only in secluded areas where they may contact people without attracting attention. Q. How fast do they fly? A. In the Earth's atmosphere they travel in excess of 20,000 miles per hour. Outside the Earth's atmosphere they can exceed the speed of light. Q. Has anyone seen them land? A. Yes, many people have seen them land, such as myself, and countless others who have not told of their experiences. Q. Do they have people in them? A. Yes, physical beings like ourselves operate the craft. Q. Do the people get out? A. Yes, when they are to make contact or gather information. Q. What do the people look like? A. They are humans and look just like we do, excepting their manner of dress. They have solid physical bodies. Q. How many people are aboard a flying saucer? A. I have never seen more than 6 in one craft, however, they can travel in units of 3, 6, 9, or the 4th of August 2012, depending on the planet from which they originate, or the polarized balance of the people in connection with the mechanics of the craft traveling through space. Q. Do the people say anything or communicate in any way? A. They communicate telepathically and aurally with whomever they may contact. Q. What do they say? A. They say they come in love and compassion for us, their brothers, to help us to help ourselves to reach a higher understanding of life and its meaning. Q. What language do they speak? A. They have their own language, unintelligible to use because of the higher frequency and different harmonics in the tonal scale. However, they can speak any language on Earth after a short period of study aided by electronic instruments. Q. Do they seem to be peacefully disposed toward us? A. They say no man can leave his planet with the purpose of conquering or controlling another world. They are not hostile. They come in love and service to the Infinite Father. Q. Did anyone ever see a craft take off? A. Yes, hundreds of people have seen them take off and have ridden in them. Q. Do the craft make any noise? A. None audible to our physical ears. Q. Are there any pictures of craft taking off? A. Yes. I have color movie films of craft taking off and landing, people getting out and stepping into the craft. I have Polaroid shots of these, which will be shown in the future. Q. Is the viewer of a craft affected in any way, emotionally, physically or mentally? A. What happens we ourselves may unwittingly cause by fear or panic. Some cases have been reported where an individual got too close to the craft while the power was still on. Q.